Choke points. Brought to you by Online Trading Academy. First responders are getting ready for a major emergency inside the new Seattle tunnel today with a large-scale realistic drill, as Colleen mentioned. But they aren't the only ones who need to prep for the tunnel opening. Everybody needs to have a plan for getting around because this transition is going to be bumpy. Here's Chris.
I don't think we can emphasize enough just how tough it is going to be getting around Seattle when the Alaskan Way Viaduct closes for good on January 11th. As you know, we're going to need 3 weeks after that to tie in the new tunnel. That's going to knock out the entire Highway 99 corridor from South Lake Union to the stadiums for 3 weeks.
There's no doubt about it. It is going to be tough. There is no, don't be confused about that at all.
Heather Marks is the director of downtown mobility for the Seattle Department of Transportation. I asked her if she's losing sleep right now, thinking about how the city is going to be moving during those 3 weeks.
I wouldn't say that it keeps me up at night, but I just hope that folks really understand that this is not a, you know, this is not a drill. This is a real 3 week closure, and that they should take the opportunity now to identify the alternate ways that they might get to work.
Find a bus route that works. Find a buddy to carpool with. Ask your company if you can flex your hours. If everybody acts like it's business as usual, this is going to be a nightmare.
I think that it's important that people start practicing that stuff right now, because you don't want the first time that you ever ride the bus to be that first day of the viaduct closure.
So you have about 3 months to figure out your plans, and more importantly, your backup plans. We are squeezed by our geography, as we all know, and there just are not a lot of north-south options through this area.
There really are very few routes north and south. You know, pick an avenue. You know, there aren't very many of them. And so, and then I-5, it's, the choices are not many.
Mark says the city is ready to handle the pressure and keep traffic moving during that initial 3 weeks, but how bad it gets will really depend on what the public does. The city is going to be tweaking light timing in real time to help ease the flow and be looking for other ways in real time to keep you moving. You should also start thinking about what life is going to be like once the tunnel opens. It's going to be free of tolls for a couple of months, but eventually there's going to be a price on using that tunnel, and that's expected to cause significant amounts of diversion to I-5 and to the surface streets through Seattle.
People are going to find their way, and it's going to take some time for people to understand what works best for them. We're hoping that people take the three-week opportunity to find a new way to get to work and that they continue to employ that. So if it turns out over that 3 weeks that the bus really works for you, we hope they'll keep using the bus.
Or light rail, or carpooling, or flexing their schedules.
Everybody just needs to be really flexible and really compassionate, and don't leave your house with only 3 seconds to spare, because that's not gonna lead to a good outcome.
What if it snows in January?
If it snows in January, that's going to be awesome, because then everyone will stay home and no one will go out there.
But they can still do the construction.
Oh, yeah.
Regardless of the weather.
Well, yeah, as far as, I mean, the paving work might and some striping work might need a little bit better stuff. But, I mean, they're pouring concrete and tying things in.
No problem.
That's one of the reasons why they pushed this past the holiday season, because there are some weather components and they didn't want it to bleed into that. But we'll see how it goes.
Pray for a snowstorm then, huh?
About a three-week snowstorm. Yeah, that would be fabulous in this region, Dave.
What is your traffic headline?
My traffic headline is we are looking at multiple miles worth of backups on multiple different roads. I'm going to start on the I-5 northbound drive next.
This is Cairo Radio. This is Seattle's Morning News. A lot of commentators have been lamenting the sorry state of Congress, as exhibited by what's going on with the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation. I'm kind of curious as to how ordinary voters are reading this. Boyd Matheson is the opinion editor at the Deseret News. And given that you work in a state that's dominated by the Mormon Church, where alcohol is, you know, a thing that you take pains to avoid, how do they look at these spate of reports about drunken parties at high schools? Is that considered a serious thing, or is that considered just a normal part of teenage behavior?
It's always one that's of great concern. I think what we're seeing playing out in the Kavanaugh hearings really is probably exhibit A, B, and C as to all the bad things that can happen when you have teens and alcohol. And so really it is about what do you carry forward. You know, George W. Bush was very open and honest about his drinking and partying during a period of his life, moved on. And to me, that's the ultimate question is, What does your behavior show as you move forward? Particularly your adult behavior, I think, is where we really have to start scrutinizing.
All right. Now, we take it to the next level. Suppose you not only attended drunken parties, but then attended a drunken party where a rape took place and said nothing about it. Then what?
Yeah, rape's very different. Very different. The partying component is one thing. Any kind of sexual assault or rape is a completely different matter. And those things have to be explored. Victims have to be heard. Also, the accused have to be heard and tell their story as well. But that's definitely the game changer.
So is it your feeling in looking at this that this is part of an orchestrated effort where the emphasis has been on just not necessarily the morality of what went on way back then, but just do whatever it takes to destroy Kavanaugh's chances of getting confirmed?
So I don't think it's all just the awful, evil Democrats and the left trying to shoot this down. I don't think that's purely it. Have there been some political maneuvers? Absolutely, no question. But to me, the important thing is that we get to the truth. And so two things. One, I think it's a good thing we've got a hearing coming up. That's the right thing to do. They need to move through that. I also think it is interesting. I don't think it was wise for Judge Kavanaugh to behave like a politician. The interview he did on Fox News with his wife by his side is exactly what a politician would do.
Well, it reminded me of Clinton, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Very, very similar to Bill Clinton. But our judges are not supposed to be politicians. They're becoming more and more so that way because Congress continues to abdicate its authority, and so things end up being politicized and ending up in the courts. But the one thing that stood out for me, and I don't know if you saw it this way, Dave, as he was going through that interview, it was almost as though he was trying to declare that he was the choir boy. And we have a rule at my house. If you have to declare it, you are not it. And I think that's kind of what came across. But, I mean, it was almost like Cory Booker saying, I am Spartacus. You know, if you have to declare you're Spartacus, you are not Spartacus. And so I don't think it was a wise move there for the judge to behave like a politician. And that's what really worries me in terms of the court as an institution, is it is becoming more and more of a political operation than it is what it's supposed to be, which is dealing with the rule of law and being, you know, unbiased, unencumbered arbitrators of the law.
Now, I understand that he feels the need to stick with this, if for no other reason at this point than to clear his name. But in terms of the president fulfilling his promise to put a conservative on the court, there would be any number of people just as conservative as him without the high school baggage that he could choose, aren't there?
That's correct. In fact, so if you looked at this strictly politically, the left would need to be careful because it is likely whoever the president appoints next would actually be more conservative than Judge Kavanaugh.
Right.
And so the two primary candidates would most likely be Amy Coney Barrett, who was among the finalists last time around. She would be more conservative than Judge Kavanaugh, or a Senator Mike Lee, who doesn't have that kind of baggage, but a very conservative record there, which would be very interesting to see if he could move through quickly through his colleagues in the Senate. I think it would be tough for them to mount the kind of opposition they have with Judge Kavanaugh.
So, Boyd, maybe that was the grand plan all along. You appoint Judge Kavanaugh, knowing he has this baggage. The Democrats raise a big fuss saying, give us someone better, give us someone with a cleaner record. And they are able then to slip by somebody even more conservative because the Democrats aren't going to want to do this twice, right?
That would be the ultimate in strategery.
Huh?
Maybe you should be a political consultant.
Donald Trump, master of three-dimensional chess.
There you go. That's it. But and so it does point out an interesting thing, Dave, and that is that, you know, so often in our rush to act, and again, whether that's the left mounting this, you know, full-scale assault and kind of dribbling in things and some 11th hour components, or whether it's the right and Judge Kavanaugh feeling like he had to immediately go and you know, do this interview on Fox News, there, you know, everyone always says the saying is, don't stand there, do something. It's the opposite. Sometimes the best thing is to don't do something, stand there. Just be still for a minute. Let the others swing wildly, and then usually you can proceed.
Boyd Matheson, the opinion editor at the Deseret News in Salt Lake City. Boyd, thanks very much.
Thanks, Dave. Always great to be with you.
Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. I'm Carolyn Osorio. New York Times bestseller, pioneering psychologist Angela Duckworth shows in her best-selling book, Grit, Power of Passion and Perseverance, that making your dreams come true has less to do with talent and more to do what she calls grit, a special blend of passion and persistence.
When you look at ratings of grit and you look at measures of talent like IQ or SAT scores, they're not related. So it doesn't mean, for example, that if you are a really hard worker that you're not talented. It doesn't mean that if you're talented, you're guaranteed to be a hard worker. They're really separate. So I think part of what my recommendation would be that we all recognize that, of course, these are both attractive things, and that if I had the choice, of course, I'd rather be both more hardworking and more talented. But I do think that in the American culture, there is a bias towards the talent. It's just more sparkly. It's more special. And I think that for many of us, when we answer that would you rather question, you know, part of us wants to say hard worker, but if we're really honest, we say talent.
At a certain point, hard work does eclipse talent. I think it was in the corporate world where the person who they'd have to have $40,000 more money in startup money, and then they'd have to have a certain amount of experience before people will then give them the kind of like, okay, you're equal to the talented person.
So that's the work of a psychologist named Chia Jung Sei. You know, she grew up as a pianist, a really competitive pianist, and she went to all these piano competitions, and she realized after going through all of this training and then these final competitions that there's a bias toward talent, and that when someone's identified as especially talented, then, you know, all of a sudden people are, you know, betting on their future as opposed to somebody who accomplishes exactly the same amount of, you know, achievement, but does it through their hard work. And what does this mean to me and to us? Well, I think that for one thing, you know, when you look at long-term achievement, even though we have this bias toward people who learn things really easily and quickly, it really is, I think, sustained effort that, you know, that makes the difference. And, you know, if you look at, for example, there are these, you know, very wise venture capitalists, like, you know, investors and, you know, people who've watched entrepreneurs their whole life. Paul Graham is one of them. He recently was, you know, writing on his blog about how if you really want to take a bet on someone and you want to make money on them, then, you know, pick the person who's tenacious and will not give up. You know, even if their early starts are not as promising as, you know, it's kind of like the tortoise and the hare, right? You know, bet on the tortoise because they're going to keep going, and don't bet on a hare that's going to give up, you know, halfway into the race.
And that was an interesting point in the book. I think people like to think of the natural winner because it makes them feel better for not being that person that puts all that work in. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and you know who came up with that insight before I did, long before I did, was Friedrich Nietzsche, the great German philosopher. And he said, why do we obsess with other people's talent? And why do we assume that genius is always something that is, well, like they can do it because they have that something special, but I can't do it? And he said, I think it's because of motivation. If we think that the genius has, you know, no extraordinary advantages, nothing magic, but that other mortals can accomplish, you know, the same thing, then now that has to push us off the couch. You know, we have no excuses anymore for procrastinating. So I do think there's a little bit of kind of self-handicapping in attributing, you know, other people's success to something that we don't have.
We have to talk about the Seahawks because obviously as part of what made me lift your book off the shelf was seeing your interview because I'm a huge Pete Carroll fan. And let's talk a little bit of, I know, I just love, you guys like seem to bond so much, like two people who are like fiercely into grit getting together. It was like the super grit. It
really resonated with him, this scientific research on grit, because he was seeing the same thing, you know, on the playing field. And I think one of the most important things that I've learned from Pete is that, you know, this is something that is actually malleable. You know, one of the most important insights from research, I would say, you know, one of the most important take-home findings of research on human nature in the last 20 years is that we are really plastic. You know, we continue learning and growing. Our brain never starts changing. That's true across the entire lifespan, whether you're 2 or 82. And I think Pete really embraces that. And he tries to create a culture in his football team that is very special and that kind of at a daily and hourly level communicates to every single person there that you're here to grow. And as he would say, you know, always compete to be your very best.
Angela Duckworth, Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this conversation.